Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the Political Center, and I'm so happy to introduce my friend on the political left, Shireen Gourvani.
Hi, and hey to the listeners.
Hi, Shireen. And sitting in for Senator Dan McKay is another good friend of mine, State Auditor John Dougal on the right. Hi, John.
Hey, great to be with you today.
John, I want to take a second right up top for our listeners and just have them get to know you a little better. I mean, I know you as someone who served in the Utah House. You've been state auditor now for a long time. You and I have a lot of fun talks about the Utah economy and libertarian thought, but maybe introduce yourself to our listeners.
Well, I think the word fun is really wonkish. Those are the kind of talks that we have. Well, yeah, I was born in Southern Cal, grew up in Portland, Oregon, moved here from the San Francisco Bay Area. People look at my politics. I'm hardcore conservative / libertarian, and I tell them I saw everything that didn't work when they look at that. Come from a large family. My nickname's Frugal Dougal. I tell folks, as the oldest of 11, frugal is all I ever knew growing up.
I love it.
Oldest of 11.
Now, Shireen, that caught your attention.
Well, because aren't you the youngest of 11?
Yeah, so we've got Anthony Scoma, our producer, John Dougal, state auditor, and Natalie Gochner, all from families of 11 children.
And I am an only child.
Well, good enough.
I never had a quiet moment.
Now, Shireen, I thought what would have caught your attention there is that John Dougal has Frugal as his middle name, and he actually shows up on the ballot that way. I don't know if you know that, Shireen. Maybe you haven't noticed, but I want to hear the story behind how you get Frugal on the ballot.
I've noticed. I also noticed, was it the last legislative session, that there was an effort to curtail nicknames on the ballot, I believe.
And it went down in flames in the Senate. I think they had 2 yes votes.
So did you know I'm sometimes an occasional DJ, and I DJ under the name DJ Legs. I feel like if I ever get back on a ballot, it's going to be Shireen DJ Legs Gourvani.
Well, the irony from my perspective is, politically, most people, I think, know me as Frugal Dougal and not really John. They actually think Frugal is my actual first name. My dad was Frugal Dougal before I was even born. It's been in my family my whole life. And so, you know, for me, there was nothing special. I just filled it out, and it's widely recognized, and that was fine.
Okay, so Frugal Dougal, let's start out by jumping into policy. President Biden has held his first cabinet meeting over the infrastructure plan. He's basically taking his cabinet members in transportation, housing, commerce, labor, and energy and having them lead the charge for a $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan. I think this is, you know, there's a lot of bipartisan support for investment in infrastructure, but the issue is how you pay for it. So, John, let's go to you first and just get your take on the $2.3 trillion infrastructure and maybe how you pay for it.
Well, the first thing I'm going to note is it's called infrastructure, but there's a whole lot of stuff that most folks don't consider infrastructure. Most people think about roads and rails, things like that. They don't necessarily expect at-home care and other things to be part of that infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Then when you get into how to pay for it, you know, you're hearing discussions about we're going to tax the corporations, as if corporations just magically have tons of money on there. And there's some complaint about, well, corporations don't pay their fair share. Some are paying zero. Well, currently we're at 21%. They're talking about raising it up to 28%. Well, 28% of zero is still zero. And so there's an interesting dynamic. One of the other things that I think is going to be a concern is President Biden said he's not going to raise taxes on anyone making more than $400,000 a year.
Under
$400,000. And then it's been changed to that's families. Individuals would be more like $200,000. Well, you start taxing corporations, that flows through. Corporations don't actually pay taxes. Their customers, their employees, their shareholders pay taxes. And so any tax burden on the corporations is going to flow out to any and all of those entities.
Shireen, I'd love to hear your comment on how you pay for it and this corporate tax thing. But I will just tell you from an economist's point of view, which I'll always do, John's right on this, meaning that we teach in public finance that only people pay taxes. Mm-hmm. Like if you tax a corporation, you're either taxing the employees, the owners, the shareholders. It always gets to people. So go ahead, Shireen.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that we'll talk a little bit about what might be happening on a global scale when it comes to where you can put your money and how you can avoid paying taxes in a particular country or another. But ahead of that, one of the things that I think is important when we think about this conversation, and, you know, as was noted, that there are some things in here that I think might fall outside of maybe a more archaic version of thinking about infrastructure. But when we consider things like how critical broadband has been and what it really means, especially for things like even healthcare and education in our rural communities. When we think about pipes and the ability and need to move water around in ways that are safe for children, for example, we have a lot of lead pipes still in this country. The kind of infrastructure investments that we need to make are crucial to our position as a superpower. And when I think about the long-term investments that we're making and the way that we've actually underinvested in a number of communities, it sets us behind in lots of ways, education, trade, many other places. So I think it's important that we figure this out and how we move forward. And I also think that it's important that we're thinking about the best in prioritizing those investments that really do have the opportunity to bring more money back into our economy as well.
Yeah. Shireen and John, I like to talk about the policy, not the politics, but there's a blend here. John, you threw out a few numbers. So corporate income tax rates at 21%. That's what President Trump did. Biden, John.
Lowered it from 35 to 21.
To 21. Always correct me if I'm wrong on my numbers. Then, Biden wants to go take it up to 28%. But he did something really smart, I thought, today, and I just read about it in the Wall Street Journal. But he talked about a 15% minimum tax on corporations that have income exceeding $2 billion. And, of course, he's going after the Amazons and the large companies that, through some clever tax work, end up not paying much tax. Just want to hear your thoughts on that, because I think it's a really smart move, because I think the American people find it offensive that large corporations find a way to not pay corporate income tax.
Well, the way we structured corporate income tax is designed for these corporations, whoever it is, to really search for ways to lower their tax burden. There's a whole lot of money spent on tax planning and tax avoidance, and that is what's in the code today. One of the concerns I have with a minimum tax is exactly how do you apply that? A minimum of what? Is this a minimum of gross receipts? Is this a minimum of income? Because you can do a whole lot of planning to avoid having taxable income. And then you get into the dynamic of yesterday, I think some of his folks were talking about a global minimum tax. And I'm a fan of tax competition. I want to see governments have to compete have entities be part of that jurisdiction and to pay those taxes. And so the fact that a corporation can go to Ireland or somewhere else, I think that's good tax competition.
Interesting. So, Shireen, I want to hear your thoughts on this tax competition. And I hate imposing our listeners all this tax talk, but Janet Yellen had a quote that I thought was so fascinating. She's the one that's asking for this 21% minimum tax on U.S. Companies' foreign income. She said, "America will compete on our ability to produce talented workers, cutting-edge research, and state-of-the-art infrastructure, not on whether we have lower tax rates than Bermuda or Switzerland."
Yeah.
Just hear your commentary there, because that's John saying I like the competition country to country, but Janet Yellen saying we're going to compete on other things.
Yes, and I do think that competition country to country would be different if we were talking about actually producing deeply in those economies. It's not like Bermuda is getting a large investment of infrastructure, of talent, of all the other things that come with a really robust and diverse economy, right? So when I think about this, I guess the thing that I just keep coming back to is that people should have to pay their fair share, and I don't think that it's fair that we have some corporations, that we have some individuals in those, in these levels of wealth that are just unimaginable to most people, having to pay so little when we think about the burden that comes back to, families here in Utah. Mm-hmm. I think people should have to pay fairly.
Well, and this is where I talk about fees versus taxes. I am an advocate of fees, user fees, or these corporations, these individuals, they pay based on the usage of the roads, the usage of rails, other things like that. They're paying a fee rather than this generic tax.
If that were the case, then you would assume that something like Amazon would be paying a lot more.
Hmm. Shireen, a totally different topic, but let's give our listeners an update on what's going on with voter suppression or whatever you want to call it. Maybe John will have a different name for it. But my goodness, is Delta and Coca-Cola, our Delta and Coca-Cola, they're making news. And our own Senator Mike Lee, who's really criticizing them and basically says, quote, "I can't fathom a legitimate, valid basis for Coca-Cola, for Delta, or any of these companies to come out and say, you can't do this."
Yeah, he also said that after noting that he had not read the law. So I think that that's an interesting place to start from. But what I would say is this is a larger conversation that's going to be happening in many different aspects of our lives. I know that there's a conversation already starting about the Olympics coming in China and what the participation should be of American companies in that space as well, right? So this is going to be a fraught issue, I think, on many fronts going forward. And I do think that there is some level of corporate social responsibility when it comes to things that are particularly egregious, like voter suppression, or, for example, in the context of China, what's happening there with the Uyghurs. So I think there are lots of complicated inroads to this conversation, but mostly I do think that those corporations have the right to use their power as they see fit in this case.
John, were you disappointed to see Coca-Cola and Delta weigh in?
Well, I'm concerned. I'm not sure they fully analyzed the bill. I think the discussion really needs to be one, integrity and security of the election, balanced with how do we improve access to voters to exercise their constitutional right. And I see two parties that are arguing past each other. One is focused on the security side. The other is easy access. And rather than how do we meld the two together into a much stronger solution. Mm-hmm. I think Utah has done a very good job of that. I look at the Georgia law as I understand it, and they're trying to engage or enact protections of some of the things that had happened during the pandemic and get that in statute. But clearly there's other issues that are in there that people are concerned with.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just say from the political middle, and I think both of you will agree with me, but Georgia really messed up on the execution of this, because I've looked at it enough to see that they did some things that I'm okay with. They also did some things that I'm not okay with, but mostly what they did is blew the message of telling people why they were doing it, how they were doing it. Even something as simple as the giving food and water in the lines, people just completely misunderstand that. Hey, we'll stay with Mike Lee in our second segment and talk about potential challengers. I'm with Shireen Gorbani and with John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. We've been talking about voter suppression in Georgia, and we're going to talk about the challengers to Senator Mike Lee. But before we do that, we have a visitor in the state this week. We have the Interior Secretary making her first visit to Bears Ears. She'll be in San Juan County, Kane County. John, you were in the legislature in the auditor's office as all of these public land issues are taking shape in our state. And I just want to let you do the setup a little bit here. What is it like in these rural counties when a new Interior Secretary comes and she's basically going to make the monument larger?
Well, for a lot of folks, especially those on the right, they're concerned because they start seeing their livelihood, their ranching, their farming, their mining, and so forth, extraction industries, all of a sudden are going to get encumbered and impaired. And then that means the schools are going to get impacted. The local businesses are going to get impacted. And so they're concerned that when these federal government fiats to expand and establish a national monument is seriously going to impact generations of their livelihood and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that is a very troubling environment. And then the other challenge is it just becomes a political football. One side expands, the next side contracts, the next side expands, and you don't have any certainty about what's really taking place, and you don't feel like you're part of the process.
Yeah. Shireen, when I served with Governor Leavitt, I remember the day that he found out about Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. He read about it in the New York Times.
Yeah, it's not good. Yeah.
Yeah, not good at all. And it was in an election year, and it was an area of our state larger than the state of Delaware, just by signature, taken away. And he was someone who loved these landscapes and wanted to preserve them to their best use, but wanted to have a public process to get there. So, Shireen, how do you view, is it Deb Haaland?
Haaland,
new Interior Secretary.
Yeah.
First Native American Interior Secretary. And
Yeah, which is incredible. I had the opportunity to meet her here a couple of years ago, and I'm just deeply impressed with her and her, I found to be very thoughtful approach. I hope that this is, you know, a dialogue. But I do think that this issue just became so nuanced for me when I was running in the second congressional district, right? So when you're down there talking to ranchers, for example, there is a lot of concern, certainly about, you know, the federal restrictions, but they're also financially benefiting when we think about the cost of, you know, grazing on BLM land versus private land. I mean, that's a huge cost to many of those ranchers that they would not be able to afford if they did not have those public lands at their disposal in that way. But of course, along with that come complications of how particular areas are maintained or how it may change on a dime. And all of that uncertainty is really a trouble for generations of families, you know? And I think there mm-hmm. is a good solution there, but I do think that solution comes through public process, public engagement, and really talking through what, frankly, as fraught as this issue has been, I think there are a lot of solutions that are within reach. And I hope that's part of this conversation this week.
Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly the most recent proposal, but from the political middle, I would love to see the Antiquities Act changed so that it's much more limited, so that we don't get this thing where Obama does one thing, Trump does another, Biden does another, and nobody has certainty. And I spent Thanksgiving down in Bluff in this part of our state. And, you know, there's two different boundaries that you see on maps mm-hmm. as you go do your thing. And it's very confusing.
So. Yeah. And Bluff's down there in San Juan County near Bears Ears.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Hey, so
Natalie, can I say one thing?
Please.
I think it should be a legislative process too. Yeah. I think that would give a little more certainty than just executive orders from a president.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, so let's go back to Senator Lead. Some articles have started to hit about potential challengers. Now, he's not on the ballot until a year from November, but it's the time. This summer is when the candidates will all make their name known. Help me list some candidates here. We've got Thomas Wright. We've got Allie Isom. We've got Becky Edwards. I think there's a Henry Irene that's saying he's going to come, a grandson or something of the more well-known Henry Irene. I hope I'm getting that right. John, this is on the Republican side, so I'll ask you, are you hearing some other names? I'm hearing Gary Herbert, by the way.
I heard his name as well. I mean, I'm not hearing it necessarily in the chatter among a lot of the delegates and Republicans that I interact with. I see it much more in the press because it makes certain stories and helps them sell mm-hmm. papers and stuff like that. But clearly, Senator Lee always has the risk of challengers. He's an interesting mix of somebody who's quite conservative in his political views and yet is oftentimes willing to reach across the aisle in ways, partnering with Bernie Sanders and others, in ways that aren't typically expected. And so he's kind of an interesting dynamic.
What do you know, John, about his bill passage record? Or Shireen, you can jump in there. I've been told that Congressman John Curtis has passed more bills than anyone in our delegation, and I just wondered what we know about Senator Lee.
I don't have those stats off the top of my head and stuff like that. I mean, sometimes it's hard to look at bill passage because sometimes bills that pass can be easy bills, and sometimes you may have concepts that pass in somebody else's bill, so they technically get the credit, even though you were working on it. I know he was dealing with criminal justice reform, and that was a major issue, and I don't believe the bill actually had his name on it, but that was clearly
a
critical guy, a player in that process.
Yeah, Shireen, your commentary.
Yeah, I think about the just connection to everyday kind of Utah issues, and I don't feel like Mike Lee is often, you know, at all close to my voice or even kind of a broad voice for many Utahns. I'm excited to see this process play out. I don't think there's a line to run. I think it's exciting to see names coming forward. And what I hope it does is ultimately create options so that people have a sense of somebody who may, you know, represent a bigger portion of the electorate here.
Any names on the Democratic side, Shireen, that you'd put out there? If you don't, I will.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to throw out Ben McAdams and Chris Peterson.
Oh, those are two great ones. Yeah, I would be proud to be represented by either of them at any level of government. But I think that there's a good debate to be had here, and I think that he should be challenged.
One of the debates...
Go ahead, John.
One of the debates we really should also have here is... It's just what should be done at the federal level versus what should be done at the state or local or individual level. And it's really, I would suggest that too much power is at the federal level. And we're sitting here worried about, let's say, two senators, Mitt Romney and Mike Lee, rather than saying, okay, let's have a greater diversity of options in the state of Utah. We have more elected officials here. They're closer to the ground. Can we do many things better than happens in D.C.? And typically nothing happens in D.C.
That's right.
I was always taught that the best government is within walking distance. So, Shireen, I'm going to go to you first because you're a Salt Lake City resident. But Mayor Mendenhall has extended Salt Lake City's mask requirement despite the end of the state mandate, which is this Saturday. Salt Lake County decided not to do this on the advice of, I believe, the health director. But, you know, I mean, I'm kind of torn on this, right? Because I don't like that there's an arbitrary date set. Yeah. But I'm also really big on just voluntary compliance of masks where it makes sense. So I'd love to hear your comments. And then, John, let's hear you talk about whether you think this is legal or not. How does the state legislature view this?
Yeah, so I've been hearing a lot from small business owners, and they do really feel like they're still in a tough spot. A lot of our restaurants, bars, small businesses, even a bakery across the street, where we have a lot of young workers who have not yet had the chance to be fully vaccinated. I think that there are many people in that community who would be much more comfortable if we really would have just waited a couple more weeks. And I hate to be like that. It's short term. But there are a lot of people that have one or are scheduled to get one very soon here. And the freedom and I guess just fear reduction that happens in that space of that first to second shot is real. My husband's a teacher. When he got that second shot, I have to say the level of relief that I felt was not something that I really anticipated for my family and for many others. I know that this is a real ongoing concern. And we're so close, right? So it seems like so a better decision could have been made.
John, I thought it was interesting, as I understand it, Mayor Mendenhall had representatives of University of Utah Health with her when she made the announcement, the members of the business community with her, and they actually see this not only as a health issue, but a business issue or an economic issue because it restores confidence and people will be out there using the restaurants and the things that people do downtown.
Well, I think one of the things here is there are some businesses that want government to decide for them so they don't have to deal in the interactions of whether they impose it or not, and it just makes it somewhat easier for them. I come from the perspective which is, if after a year we haven't figured out when masks do and don't work, then we've got bigger problems going on. I'm there where personal decisions, personal choices should take place. We should still be sensitive of what's going on. But when you see somebody running in a very vacant area with a mask on, you start to wonder what's really going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, I heard at the press conference, Mayor Mendenhall referenced the percent of the west side that was vaccinated versus the east side. Mm-hmm. I thought it was pretty compelling, you know, that it's really easy for people who are in positions of power to lift mask mandates based on their reality. But there's people in the society that don't have that reality. I just thought I'd throw that out there. I thought that was an interesting perspective.
Yeah, and I think it's the right perspective, right? And again, we're so close. So it just would be nice to have a little bit of a longer runway to get this right and, you know, put people in a position where they could be healthy.
Shireen saying two more weeks. Two more weeks.
About,
two more weeks.
Honestly.
John, I'm going to ask you because I believe you're a Utah County resident. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So Utah County Commission's been making a lot of news. Do you mind setting that up and telling us what you see there and bringing in you into county as well?
So one of the dynamics in Utah County is they recently took action to move the budget officer from the county auditor under the county commission. And while there's various reasons why that may make sense, the speed at which they did it, basically noticing it in 24 hours or so taking action, didn't bring the public along. And you talked about the importance of bringing the public along in public policy decisions. And that was one of the major problems. And there was clearly a lack of communication or lack of adequate communication between the commissioners and the county auditor going on there. That same week didn't get as much coverage, but the Uinta County Commission looked to move the accounting function and take it from the county auditor and move it under the commission, which is even a more troubling kind of dynamic. And they were trying to make the case that it improves separation of duties, where actually it calls into question separation of duties. And many folks that came to testify against it expressed those concerns out there.
Interesting. Shireen, you've been in service as an elected official in Salt Lake County. Interested in your commentary, and particularly, did you like what Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson did there, where she used some of her political capital to take on people in her county?
Yeah. I think what's happening is a concerning consolidation of power, or power grab is how it's been referred to by many others. The lack of transparency, the speed, all of these things do not suggest good governance. And I think that the public really does deserve more. And I'm proud of her for stepping up and saying something.
Yeah,
well, one of the interesting dynamics here is We're taught about the federal level, a single president runs the executive branch. We actually have multiple folks that run the executive branch in the state of Utah. And at the county level, you have even more players. You've got a county attorney, county sheriff, county auditor, county treasurer, so on. They each run pieces of the executive branch. And we don't learn about that in school.
1 minute left to both of you, and I'm gonna end with a doozer. Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had their general conference this weekend. Elder Oaks, who is the incoming prophet, the way it works in the hierarchy, he gave a talk disputing belief that LDS should be Republicans and said that no platform or individual candidate represents all the church's positions. Shireen, we'll go to you first as a non-LDS commentator, and then we'll go to John as an LDS commentator.
So I saw some chatter on the left on Twitter on this, reacting and honestly feeling like people had been seen, and that it made some people who often feel a little at home in terms of the combination of maybe where they sit in their faith and where they sit in their politics, that they really welcomed the message. And so I think when we're creating spaces where people feel more welcome, that's good.
John.
Natalie, one of the things from my perspective is I've always joked somewhat seriously, I'm not sure how any good LDS member can be a member of any political party.
Very good. We'll just leave it there. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. We welcome John Dougal's perspective on this program, as well as Shireen Gorbani. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.